Exodus 16:1 through 16:36, the 18th talk in a series on Exodus, was presented by David Crabtree on December 15, 1996, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
16. We're going to be talking about God giving to the Israelites food in the form of manna. It's a remarkable story. One of the things that that I have found very interesting in reading through this section is how we see God working in very dramatic ways, in ways that must have been very impressive to the Israelites. And then the next day, they wake up and they still are prone to headaches. The sand still gets between their toes. Mosquitoes still bite. That real life strikes again. That this mundane keeps coming back in, and it takes its toll. It's as if the mundane begins to rule and to push out what God has done. What God has done pales in comparison to the little everyday kinds of problems. Here in chapter 16, the Israelites they've seen God act extremely dramatically in the plagues that he inflicted upon Egypt. Then God opened up the Red Sea and they walked through on dry land. And God killed the Egyptian army. Then a few days later, they were thirsty and had not had water for 3 days. They come to water, which they finally find water, but it's not drinkable. And God tells them to throw a tree in the water, and the water becomes drinkable, and they drink. So there are a number of things that God has done in a short period of time that are really dramatic. They are life-saving things, that acts that God has performed. And yet, a few days later, they begin to grumble. And that seems to be the pattern, because it's the mundane that comes in and begins to rule. Chapter 16, verse 1. They set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from the land of Egypt. Now, Elim, if you'll remember back to the chapter before, that was where there were 12 springs of water and 70 date palms. We are now 6 weeks into their exodus. About 6 weeks ago, they left Egypt. We know it took them 3 days to get to Mara. We don't know how long they stayed at Mara, but then they moved from Mara to Elim. We don't know how long they were there, but presumably they were at each place for a number of days. In any case, we are now six weeks into their trip, and they are now in the desert of Sin. They have left Elim, where the oasis was. Verse 2, and the whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the sons of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by pots of meat, and we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." So we get that verb again, grumbled. They grumbled. This is the one that keeps reappearing. That it's not just what they're saying, but it's the attitude behind it that's really significant. It's the whole congregation that grumbles. So it's characteristic of the whole group that they are grumbling. And who do they grumble to? It's against Moses and Aaron. So they direct their anger not at God, and I suspect it's out of fear. They are directing their grumbling to the human instruments of God. And I suspect that their fear is that God is no longer paying attention. God is no longer interested in their predicament. And they are turning to the human representatives, the ones that most obviously have led them into this situation. And what they complain about is they say, we would have been better in Egypt. There was lots of food. There were pots of meat. And we ate bread to the full. So there was plenty to eat there. Here we have nothing. Therefore, it was better back there. All they're thinking about is their physical comfort, their physical condition. And by that measure, they would have been better off in Egypt. Then they accuse Aaron and Moses of having brought them out to kill this whole assembly with hunger. We're all going to die here. We would have been better off back in Egypt. Here, this is suicidal. This is pointless. Okay, God's response in verse 4. Then the Lord said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them, whether or not they will walk in my instructions. And it will come about on the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily. There are a lot of difficult interpretive questions in this section. I won't go into all of them, but they are issues of chronology. In particular here, he's talking about the sixth day. God is saying on the sixth day such and such, and the Sabbath has not yet been declared, at least in the chronology of Exodus. So chronologically, there's some things that are difficult to sort out here, but I won't bother with those. God's response to the problem is, it's easy. Rain, food will rain down from heaven for you. I'll fix this. Food is just going to drop out of heaven like rain, and you will be provided for. And every day you'll just go out and pick it up. It'll be there. But God goes on to say that I may test them. That the way that God is going to provide food for them is also going to constitute a test for them to see if they will follow his instructions. Just as at the spring of Marah, at the water of Marah, there was a test involved. Throughout this Exodus, we see these testings. God is both providing, and at the same time, there's a test involved in that provision. And he makes clearer what that provision will be as he goes on with his instructions. In verse 6, then, Moses and Aaron speak to Israel and tell them what God has revealed to them. So Moses and Aaron said to all the sons of Israel, at evening you will know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord. For he hears your grumblings against the Lord. And what are we that you grumble against us? And Moses said, this will happen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and bread to the full in the morning. For the Lord hears your grumblings, which you grumble against him. And what are we? Your grumblings are not against us, but against the Lord. So as Moses tells the people of Israel what's going to happen, he says that in the evening you will receive meat, and in the morning you will receive bread. And this will be an indication to you, proof to you, that I am still in control of things. Things have not gotten out of hand. I've heard your grumblings. I know what suffering you're going through. I understand it, and I am responding to it. I will take care of your needs. And in a dramatic fashion, they will have plenty of bread and they will have plenty of meat, provided in straight from heaven. Verse 9, then Moses said to Aaron, say to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumblings. And it came about as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the sons of Israel that they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, I have heard the grumblings of the sons of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. It must have been a very dramatic sight at a time when they were wondering whether God was still there, whether God was still active in their wanderings in the desert, if they've been taken out to the desert and then abandoned by this God. But no, he was present, he was listening to their concerns, and he was going to respond to those concerns in a dramatic fashion. Verse 13, it describes how that happened. So it came about at evening that the quails came up and covered the camp. And in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the layer of dew evaporated, behold, on the surface of the wilderness, there was a fine flake-like thing, fine as the hoar frost on the ground. When the sons of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? And in Hebrew, that's manna, manna. For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it every man as much as he should eat. You shall take an omer apiece according to the number of persons each of you has in his tent. And the sons of Israel did so, and some gathered much, and some gathered little. When they measured it with an omer, he who had gathered much had no excess, and he who had gathered little had no lack. Every man gathered as much as he should eat. So there are two things that God is doing to provide them with food. One is the quail. In the evening, they look around and there are quail all over the ground. Apparently, this is not an unheard of phenomenon in the Sinai, that I'm not going to get this right. It's something about the quail migrating at a certain time of the year, and they meet strong headwinds going across the Mediterranean, and I guess if they meet strong headwinds going across the Mediterranean, when they arrive in the Sinai, they're too tired to fly. So they land and they can't fly. They're just on the ground. But this is if it's just this phenomenon or something else, in any case, God is providing quail for them. The quail are right there to be had, easy to get in the evening. Then in the morning, they get up and there's this stuff all over the ground, this crust. And they just collect this crust, and it is edible. It's their food. And the instructions were, has he told them how much they're supposed to gather? God had told them to gather as much, every man, as much as he should eat. Now, he hasn't told them for just the day, has he yet? That's coming up. They're supposed to gather a certain amount. They're supposed to gather the amount that they can eat in a day. No more and no less. And they go out and gather it, and this is a little difficult for me to sort out. But verse 6:17, and the sons of Israel did so. Some gathered much and some gathered little. 18, when they measured it with an omer, he who had gathered much had no excess, and he who had gathered little had no lack. Every man gathered as much as he should eat. Now, I think what it's describing here is some people went out and really mined this stuff. I mean, they just worked hard, gathering just as much as they could. And others went out and just kind of played at it. But when all was said and done, whether they really worked hard at it or whether they just kind of played at it, they had enough. That's not the only way to take this, but I think that's what it's saying, indicating that the amount that they ended up with was not according to their labor, wasn't according to their merit. But rather, the amount that they received was the amount according to what they needed. Verse 19, and Moses said to them, let no man leave any of it until morning. But they did not listen to Moses. And some left part of it until morning. And it bred worms and became foul, and Moses was angry with them. You can imagine what's going on here. They've been hungry. Some of them were fearing that they would die of hunger. And so some of them are going out and they want to get as much as they possibly can, because who knows when this will happen again. And God says, don't leave any for the next day. But some of them are saying, that's crazy. We can get as much as we want here. We can get lots. We can store this up. And we can have it for the future. What they're concerned about is their security. What they're concerned about is, God may have taken care of us today, but we don't know about tomorrow. The only way we can make sure that we're cared for tomorrow is if we do it. If we care for ourselves. But this man is strange stuff. God's so bizarre. I mean, there are other ways he could have provided for their needs, but he comes up with this manna stuff. And this manna stuff has a very short shelf life. So if they gather more than they need out of their insecurity, what happens? It rots. So they can work till their hands bleed. But tomorrow, they still won't have food unless it comes down out of heaven again. And they gathered it morning by morning, every man as much as he should eat. But when the sun grew hot, it would melt. So there's a specific period of time during which they need to gather this. God is in complete control of this time schedule here. God is providing on his own terms, according to man's need, not on man's terms, according to man's wants. Verse 22, now it came about on the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for each one, when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses. Then he said to them, this is what the Lord meant. Tomorrow is a Sabbath observance, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over put aside to be kept until morning. So they put it aside until morning, as Moses had ordered, and it did not become foul, nor was there any worm in it. And Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord, and you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be none. And it came about on the seventh day that some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. Then the Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my instructions? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore he gives you bread for 2 days on the sixth day. Remain every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. So this manna is specially created stuff that reinforces the instructions that God has given. If you violate the instructions that God has given, then it goes bad on you. Or you run out. So God is impressing upon them the need to follow his instructions. And if they follow his instructions, there will be provision for them. He's taking care of them. But on all of these instructions, there are people who violate them. People who do not trust him to take care of them. Verse 31, and the house of Israel named it manna, and it was like coriander seed, white, and its taste was like wafers with honey. Then Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer full of it be kept throughout your generations, that they may see the bread that I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. And Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer full of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. And the sons of Israel ate the manna 40 years until they came to an inhabited land. They ate the manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. Now an omer is a tenth of an ephah. 40 years is a long time to be eating manna. It is apparently fairly versatile. You can bake it. You can boil it. I think Martha Stewart even boils it or barbecues it. It is apparently versatile stuff. There's the different things you can do with it, but still it's manna. And you can imagine 40 years of any one thing would get tiresome. And yet, the thing that's absolutely remarkable about it is for 40 years, they were cared for on a daily basis as they're going through wilderness. Absolutely incredible that the daily care that God was taking of them. And yet, with every kind of blessing from God, it is our tendency as human beings to take that for granted. And what we'll see is that the Israelites, despite this daily provision for their needs, still have times when they wonder whether God is in control, whether God can be trusted to take care of them. And here is a situation in which God's provision then becomes part of the mundane. This is just the way things are. It's not God's provision of us, it's just these things happen. And as a result, a tendency to put a division between what just happens and what God is doing, therefore taking him for granted. This manna is a very interesting device for God to use to teach the people of Israel that he is the one that provides life. He's the one who brings this sustenance and makes it possible for them to live day after day after day. And it's not their intelligence, it's not their industriousness, it's nothing on their part that's making this possible. Rather, it's God's provision. And he's providing it on his time schedule according to need. As he sees it from his perspective, not according to our time schedule and responding to the needs as we see them. And this manna is a tool for him to show them that this is from God. God's doing this. Which means that security then depends on trusting God. They will be as secure as they are faithful with respect to God. They'll be as secure as they trust him. If they don't trust him, there is no security. Yes, Margaret.
I know periodically the question comes up where something miraculous has happened and there's some natural phenomenon that corresponds to it or may not, and you said that the miraculous doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, violating the laws of physics. It's more in the timing. But my first question is there any natural phenomenon that has been found to correspond to the manna? And second of all, even if they have seen swarms of quail and, you know, with headwinds and that kind of thing, it seems like that couldn't possibly be a year-round phenomenon year after year after year. So So I guess those are my questions. Mm-hmm. It seems like violating the laws of physics seems quite possible with the quail, and I don't know if there's anything equivalent to the manna.
Well, this is a topic, you're right, it has come up almost every week, and I think it's one I would still like to talk about that, but I need to spend some time sorting out exactly how I want to talk about that. There is another phenomenon that people have pointed to that is similar to the manna. And that is, there are some insects that live in the desert that when they, it's kind of like, they're aphid-like insects. And as they eat, when they overeat apparently, all of the sugars that they can't use passes right through. And so they're can be the stuff, aphid droppings, that's very sweet. But that's a, even if that accounts for it, what's...
Is it the color of a coriander seed?
White coriander seeds. This stuff was there every day, except Sundays, for 40 years. So it's a, I guess it would be an aphid blight for 40 years that would bring this about. And with the quail, it's mentioned that the quail arrive here. It doesn't say that the quail continue for 40 years. The only one that we had that it specifically says that they had for 40 years was the manna. So I don't know. I don't know if the aphids account for it or not. Yes.
I'm a little bit confused. A flock of quail show up in the evening. They wake up in the morning. There's stuff all over the ground, and they're wondering what it is.
And Moses is saying it's aphid droppings. Any other enlightening comments?
Yes. It talks about how they would, whether they gathered a little or a lot, they had enough for that day. And then immediately it talks about people who stored up a bunch of stuff for the next day. How are they even able to have stuff to store up and try to save?
Yeah. One possibility is that they didn't eat all that they were allotted that day, that they're rationing in it. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that that Moses here is speaking in generalities, and that this is generally the case, but there could be exceptions to this. My suspicion is that he's speaking in general terms and that there are exceptions to this, but I'm not sure. Margaret?
This Tuesday I taught a class at the study center on the fallacy of salvation by works, and in studying that I found out that the law was given about a year after they came out of Israel, or out of Egypt, and all this stuff is going on in that year. And it struck me that, of course, now in hindsight, in Revelation, we know what the purpose of the law was, but the motif we keep coming up with is people want to be in control of their own well-being. They don't want to trust God. They want there to be a cause and effect between their behavior and their well-being. And they don't want God to just give it to them. And that's certainly what the law... It seems very often in Scripture we see the people wanting things that are bad for them, but God says, okay, you know, they wanted a king. God said, you're not going to like it. They wanted a king anyway, so we gave them a king. They didn't like it. So they're saying, we want to be in control of our well-being. So, okay, here's the law. We'll tell you, you do this, you will have well-being. You don't do this, you won't have well-being. And so they didn't do a great job when they were in control of their well-being. That seems to fit really well into the purpose of the law. That theme of people wanting to be in control, and finally God lets them, give them what they want, and they discover that they can't do it, that the only alternative they have to well-being is to let God be.
One of the things that I've noticed in these first few chapters of Exodus is that one of the conflicts is the Israelites are looking at their lives and they're saying, I need X. And God is not providing X. Therefore, God does not care for me. God is not taking care of me, at least. But we see from another perspective, from God's perspective, X isn't what they need at all. But they really need something very different. And it's that missing that it takes a long time to understand that we aren't very good at running our own lives. We think we know what we need and when we need it and how we need it. But in fact, part of the problem is we aren't very good at determining what we need and how we need it and when we need it. And that even that we have to put in God's hands. Not only to provide to us what we need, but to diagnose what we need in the first place. Logan?
Do you think they were really, that their criticisms were valid, that when they were in Egypt they had enough to eat, and now we're out here going hungry, and when we were in Egypt there was always plenty of water, and now we're out here where we're thirsty? Or are they just getting this glorified hindsight?
Well, my suspicion, on the basis of what I know of Egyptian culture, which is not great, but I know a little, Egypt was the richest country in the world. They had food was easier to produce there than any place else in the ancient world. And so the amount of food, generally speaking, was not a problem. And they depended very heavily on slave labor. They worked them hard, but they also took care of them. So if our measure of quality of life is the dipstick on our stomach, then they did fine in Egypt.
It brings up, for me, it brings up the question of God's right to appropriate these people for his own ends, whether or not it made them comfortable or not. I've heard the Exodus used to champion anti-slavery, democracy, I mean all kinds of things. You know, freedom from slavery is a big issue for people. And it strikes me that maybe God's not that overly concerned with them being free from slavery as much as he is stealing them from that culture and making them into who he wants them to be. Because he took them into slavery, into Babylon. But he did that to make them the people he wanted them to be.
That's right.
And I think it strikes me that it's just not right to see this as, who's the guy that produced Ten Commandments, the movie?
Cecil Peterman.
Was that, he directed it, who produced it?
Oh, I don't know.
It's a Jewish guy. But he comes out, if you get the Letterboxd edition, he comes out and he says that the whole point of the story is the Exodus is whether man shall serve God or the state. And I'm not sure that's really the whole point. Mm-hmm. Isn't the whole point that God has a right to just, and will, like he did with Abraham, come down and say, you're mine, let's go? Mm-hmm.
I think the issue of what is slavery and what is freedom is something that we need to think about very carefully. The problem is we are contingent beings. We are dependent on something for everything. if we don't have food, we die. And so what in Dylan's song is very true. Everyone serves somebody. And so what is freedom possible then? Well, there's a sense in which freedom is not possible. We cannot be independent beings, self-sufficient beings. But there is a sense in which freedom is possible, and that is to acknowledge rightful authority. But that ultimately is true freedom. So what God was doing with the people of Israel was taking them out of slavery in Egypt and making them His people. And that's freedom. It's not freedom from all authority. That's not the goal. That's impossible. Freedom is putting ourselves subject to rightful authority, and that is God. And I think that's what this process is. That's what He wants to do, is take them away from false authorities, inappropriate authorities in Egypt, and teach them that what He wants is subjection to Him, them to be subject to Him and obedient to Him.
Yet in the overall, He didn't succeed, for the majority of these Israelites never made the Promised Land. We don't know about if a few individuals along the way really appreciated what was going on, and then this prelude to the Ten Commandments, did they really respect manna? Did they really depend upon the Lord? And so some few might have, but even further as far as the principle of what we're reading now, it might be the purpose of education, of education of the sons of the Israelites, of the education of us as we read it. For the 600,000 men and their associated peoples, if it's true, the majority of them didn't make it.
Yeah. It's sobering.
I was going to follow with one other thing. It's not quite connected, but in the last 6 weeks, the Lord has said to the Israelites, on a few occasions, I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart for my glorification, and I'm going to open up the Red Sea, and I'm going to take care of those guys for my glorification. And it's a demonstration, I think, a personal demonstration to them, as opposed to, I have a footnote in my NIV Bible that says, there's no record, there's no historical archaeologic proof or magnification of this experience, the hardening of Pharaoh's heart and the glorification of the Lord. And I was going to ask you to comment on, it seems then, therefore, that He did this just for their personal appreciation, not for the history books. Maybe you know some more information where the history books might come into.
What did the note say?
It said that there was not very much archaeologic information or Egyptian writings that proved that the Pharaoh and his armies were killed in the Red Sea, and therefore it established the glorification of the Lord. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess.
Yeah, as far as I know, there isn't. Someone just gave me a videotape that. In which he says that an archaeologist claims that there is such proof. I haven't seen it yet. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But I don't think archaeological evidence is what would preserve that for us. I think it's the text itself, I think, has preserved that fact for us and for posterity. So there's a sense in which the hardening of Pharaoh's heart was a lesson to the Israelites at that time, but it continues to be a lesson to us downstream, simply because it made it into Scripture, and we have God's record of that event. And we see Pharaoh then being used as a tool of God. We understand what's God's working in history through people to bring about His purposes.
The other aspect of the footnote was that it didn't make it to the Egyptian newspapers. There wasn't a written historical account
right.
of this experience.
Right.
And so I have to conclude if you couldn't supply any additional historical information, that the purpose was education of the Israelites at that time for the glorification of the Lord.
I see.
To recognize that he's the guy that's providing the quail. He's the guy that opens up the sea.
Yeah.
And it's a lesson. It's not... It's just a concern, maybe, that it's not historically preserved. But indeed, then I have to say, well, that wasn't the point. That wasn't necessary.
Yeah. But it was historically preserved here. The Egyptian presses were heavily censored. We have a number of incidents in which disastrous things happened to Egypt and were recorded in the cultures around them, but there is silence with respect to those things in Egypt. So they were very selective in their compilation of their own history and deleted those things which would reflect negatively on Egypt and its gods.
Later we're going to see when they are going to the land that the people are shivering in terror.
They know about it. Yes, the news has certainly preceded the Israelites all the way through this march. And as every people that they approach, those people are already shivering in their boots as the Israelites come. We need to quit. Thanks.